Thank you again for being with us as we continue through the Ten Commandments, Commandments 7 and 8 tonight. Both interesting in their own way, probably particularly from a historical standpoint of what our people have done with them, not just our people, but the ways in which we have interpreted them and transmitted them. As we move into the seventh commandment, which is, you know, thou shalt not, do not commit adultery, we obviously understand that anybody who has been affected by that, that is a painful reality. That is a struggle and a difficulty. We know that, you know, there are, we have all found ourselves on the wrong side of commandments, but that is one I think that is particularly difficult. So we mean not to point any fingers tonight other than what we think the commandment says to us, and again, some of what we think it has said to our ancestors in the faith. So this is the third commandment regulating human relationships. That second table that we've talked about, honor your father and mother, do not murder. And now we have that focus specifically turning toward family. We got some of that with father and mother, and now we get the marriage relationship as well. And this commandment, I think when we talk about, as we've tried to the last few weeks, the idea that the commandment is bigger than just the one thing that it points out, I think maybe this is the commandment that is most convicting once you realize that you're not innocent of it. In other words, even if you check the box that says, well, I've not done that, something in the expansion of this commandment, when Jesus talked about this commandment, he equated breaking this commandment with lust. And at that point, when Jesus makes that bridge, we all kind of get included in a way that probably feels convicting. The idea of inappropriately thinking about someone or something or looking at things that we shouldn't see. So on the surface, this isn't a commandment that needs a lot of explanation. I think people are familiar with what adultery means. However, when we look at our sexuality and our commitment to one another in relationship, it changes pretty quickly. This commandment expands, that net gets really big really fast. And I think most of us, even though we might start off feeling fairly confident, realize, oh, no, I guess that one is saying something to me as well.
So there's a certain level of importance, I think, in this ordering. So I just want to, not to repeat what Clint said, but let's look at those ordering of human relationships. So the first one in the second table is honor your father or mother. So this kind of hierarchical relationship between you and your superior, right? Then the second is do not murder, the preservation of life. So the third then is a commandment regarding your most personal relationship, protecting the family order. And what is interesting about that is, number one, from the societal perspective, this is essential to people who are going into very difficult circumstances to protect the family order and to make it possible for them to succeed. But it also has a way of keeping society within an order in which it's possible to do the things that society needs to do, to raise children, to be able to pass on the faith from one generation to the next. It also creates a kind of system and order by which you can sort of pass down tradition from family lineage. Now, we would be not totally, we would have to give ourselves some grace if we think of this commandment from our perspective. But you, for a moment, remember all of your stories from the Old Testament where there are often multiple wives. There's often a significantly different social order than what we take for granted in our own time or place. So you need to remember that when you're remembering this commandment, that this is more than just what we would think of as in one man, one wife. This is being received in a time in which that has a much more broad kind of interpretation. But that said, the point of it remains the same, to keep a kind of basic societal order so that you can pass on in an order the faith as well as the ability for family members and humans to grow in the midst of difficult circumstances. So it provides a way to put order in a rather broken type situation, people who are moved towards a disorder in their lives. And, you know, we have, as we think about the New Testament, we have major themes about things like faithfulness, the idea of being faithful to God first, which we have in the first table, and then being faithful to one another. That is, I think, expressed in this commandment pretty clearly from the start. I'll be really brief with this because I don't want to bore you all right at the start, or do you want to say something there? Okay. So this next movement of this is probably not a thing you immediately care about, so I'm going to try to make you care about it for a second. The ancient church cared a lot about celibacy. We don't know what to do with that in modern first world America. But the reality is that it mattered a lot to them that you had a theology that made sense of what if you don't get married? Or what if you can't have children? Because you have to remember, when your societal order follows directly down the path of who's your firstborn son, and then you have all those stories in Genesis when that just doesn't happen and how tumultuous that is, you have to think, so what does it mean then if you are someone who is celibate, who is not in a marriage relationship and who's not acting outside of a marital relationship? And the early church talked extensively about how celibacy is a gift and a virtue granted by God. Maybe the closest you can get to this is in the Catholic Church today. If you are a father, if you're a priest, or if you're a nun, you're not married. There are actually exceptions to that throughout the world. Not very often, but it does happen. But largely the idea is you are married to Christ. The time you would put in investing in the human relationship is instead put in a spiritual relationship with God and in the effort of loving your neighbor. And so here, Calvin makes the point that we should recognize that the commandment of marriage, the fact that God gives us a commandment of marriage, gives marriage a certain level of primacy or importance in our lives. That, in other words, God is saying that this is a good covenantal relationship that you should desire. That said, Calvin doesn't go so far as to say that it is the only blessed relationship. He wants to say that you don't have to have a marriage to be a blessed Christian. You don't have to have that kind of relationship to be a person who God can give the special virtue of celibacy. And you have to know that's a pretty brash claim for Calvin, who is arguing against the Catholic Church, and he himself arguing that pastors should get to have wives. So this for him is a theological kind of minefield, and so it's significant that he wants to preserve the idea that there is virtue in having a non-marital relationship, you being married to God, you being celibate, you investing that time in a relationship that's not a marriage. I've not done a very good job of convincing you why you should care about this, other than I the point here being, you need to know that a commandment that involves covenantal relationship and marriage involves the messy, complicated human stuff outside of that. And they cared about that, and they thought about it.
Yeah, so...
try to transition with that.
Let me just add a little bit to that idea. When the Bible speaks of celibacy, it actually speaks about it as a gift. So in the earliest evolution of the church, they lived under the expectation that Jesus would be back any day. And so in that context, Paul says things like, it's better if you don't get married, but if you need to get married, go ahead. But it is a gift to you if you can focus on your faith, because we know Jesus is going to be back any minute now. What is interesting, I think, about that is, A, that Paul understands that level of purity, so no sex outside marriage and intentionally not being married, is not an act of will, it is a spiritual gift. That's how he talks about it. And secondly, that the expectation of purity outside of marriage transfers over to inside of marriage. That sexuality inside of marriage, though permissible, is still dangerous and still needs fences around it. That simply being married is not a kind of guarantee against things like lust and adultery. And we go back to Jesus' words that when you look at someone lustfully, you've committed adultery in your heart, which is, you know, what he says. And so while marriage is the primary pathway to purity and sexuality for Christians, Calvin and Luther have, and based on Paul, have argued that it's not the only. And I think that's significant. I think in the context of where they were as a society, it is an incredible thing that Paul says to people, if you don't need to get married, don't. Now, that doesn't sound like great advice, though I've heard people say that, but they don't mean what Paul means. They mean, why don't you just live together? Why do you need to get married? That's not what Paul meant at all. But the idea that he puts that out there is significant, and our people pick up on that. So then the question turns to, what is the character of relationship? And with that idea of purity, the character of relationship is to be pure, both in our pre-marriage relationships and in our marital relationship. I think this is your quote, Michael, from Calvin. Modesty is purity in heart and chastity in body. So purity in heart we get. A lot of people would say that it's a good thing to be pure with your heart. I think chastity is not a word that 21st century America knows what to do with. The idea of being chaste, the idea of being restrained, the idea of being restricted. We don't live in a moment where that is celebrated very highly. But we are responsible for that. From a biblical worldview, from a biblical perspective, that is the nature of this commandment, that we are required, we are expected to set limitations for ourselves and pursue purity or faithfulness, whichever it is that our station demands.
Yeah, so purity is, in our view, most often an individual reality. We know we're responsible for what we do with our own bodies. But the early church was very, very interested in also recognizing the importance of modesty. In other words, your attempts to help your neighbor be pure. Because you think in the early church, they're a highly communal group of people. They care a lot about helping each other live out their faith. And so you have things that we wrestle with here today, still in the 21st century church. Paul writing things like women, you know, don't wear this kind of adornments and don't do these things. The spirit behind that was the idea of keeping this commandment. The idea behind it was, as far as it is for you, do what you can to help your neighbor remain chaste, remain pure. And that not just with what they do with their body, but also what they do with their imagination and what they do with their mind. And this is all the more complicated because of Jesus's move. We know Jesus's teaching. He says it's not enough to just not act on a sexual impulse outside of your marriage. Jesus says that simply looking with lust is breaking the commandment. And when he does that, he makes this unbelievably impossible in 21st century America to just simply say, and that's what it is. Because we live in a moment in which it's not just access to that kind of sexualized reality. Our culture continues to think about it as an ultimate place of freedom. How could you restrict any form of what I do with my body? As long as it's consensual, it's fine, right? And if you're a Christian, you have to hold that intention with God's covenantal image for human relationship. God has made a covenant with us. God expects us to make covenants with others. And that means that we agree to certain boundaries and terms for the health of our relationship with God and our relationship with others. That it's a difficult conversation because people will say, well, ultimately, aren't all restrictions bad? And you say, well, no, some restrictions are essential, right? Things like nobody loves getting pulled over for having a speeding ticket, right? But the fact that our roads are regulated, I guess I'll very quickly tell you, this is a bit of a field, I promise I'll bring it around. So we were on our way back. We were on our way back from this thing that we did in Jamaica to the cruise ship this November, and we were late, which we didn't know until our bus driver started driving like we were an ambulance or a police car. And we drove on every part of the road that's imaginable and other parts I didn't know existed. Like we drove off on the shoulder. We had goats cross the road and he interwove between them. We blew through intersections with red lights. We honked at cars until they moved off the road. And in that moment, I realized, oh, I live in a place where roads are highly regulated. Because this guy drove and everyone else knew what to do with him. But I was kind of white-knuckling, hoping that we made it back to the ship. And by the way, he got us there on time. So thank you, driver. But the reason I say that is very simple. It's easy to take the boundaries for granted if you've always lived for them. It's easy to take the benefits of shelter and protection, which is what God intends for the community by giving these commandments. This is what you should do for the sake of your community. This is the best way to live. And we sometimes turn that into a thing that society certainly turns that into a thing that needs pushed back against. And the church has learned things in that pushback. But ultimately, the intent of this is to provide a safe structure in which the community can thrive and grow.
So just back to that idea of modesty for a minute. One, Michael mentioned the church kind of, having conversations that maybe the culture occasionally helps us have. You don't have to respond to this if you don't want, but if you're a female in the group and you grew up in church, at some point, would you, if you're comfortable, would you raise your hand if you were told that you had to dress carefully so boys wouldn't look at you in the wrong way? So some of you have heard that, right? Women have borne an inordinate amount of blame in regard to these commandments. And some of that is, it was men writing them, and it was easier to blame women. So we did. And I'm okay with that. No, I'm just... But we have tried to learn that it's not simply that easy to say who is at fault. But again, and if you have, you know, if you've done the thing, if you've raised daughters or granddaughters recently, if you know young people in this day and age, the concept of modesty is brutally hard to communicate. Why shouldn't I wear my volleyball shorts to Walmart? And why can't I wear yoga pants and a crop top to the park? And why? Well, you can, but should you? And so that's a very hard conversation to have when that's the water that our young people swim in. What does it mean to be modest? And we are hopefully landing in a better place than it's your job to make sure boys don't look at you wrong, right? As a dad of daughters, I didn't find that a helpful metric. Like, you need to be unattractive because otherwise, you know, they could have lust when they look at you. Well, it's not their fault. However, that doesn't mean that modesty doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that purity doesn't matter. We live in a culture, I think this is one of the probably the great disconnects. You know, if we said don't murder, we go out and talk to secular people and they'd say, yeah, that seems good. if we went out and said, we think modesty and purity matter and lust is not helpful, they'd say, what are you talking about? This is one of the biggest disconnects I think Christians have with the world in which we live. If you look at the statistics and the figures for things like online pornography, if you look at clothing, if you look at this idea of you can do anything as long as there's consent, if you listen at all to our culture, this is a place where I think the church, particularly the historic church, and the modern world are a chasm apart. We are miles apart on how we think about sexuality, how we think about maturity, how we think about relationships and responsibilities. And that makes a thing like marriage difficult. Now, and marriage is already tough. Michael and I were talking about this a little while ago. You know, every time we do a wedding, and 9 times out of 10, those are two young people looking at each other and they're thinking, oh, this is so, finally, we're great. And we're thinking, oh, you have no idea. You just have no idea, right? Because you just can't imagine the scope of being in a covenant with another human being every day for the rest of your life. That's not an easy thing. You can't imagine where that's going to take you. You can't imagine the temptations and the struggles that are going to be. And then here you have a culture that says, well, just here's your outs. Get on the computer, do this, do that, whatever you want. It's okay. Well, it isn't. We don't take our marching orders from the culture. And so this is a place where I think Christians often seem old-fashioned. Sometimes we seem judgmental. Sometimes we are. But I think Christian people understand that there is a danger to lust. That it is a gift. Our sexuality is a gift, but it's a gift that comes with responsibility, and it's a gift that needs to be understood and to some extent protected, because when it is let out without restriction, it does damage to people. It hurts people. And so not just about protecting marriages, but protecting people, protecting minds and hearts. And I think, you know, again, rightly understood, this is a convicting commandment. It's easy to say, well, I haven't done that. But when you start unpacking it, you go, oh, well, okay, I guess I'm in there somewhere. But I think also a crucial commandment, and one that the church is going to continue to struggle with. This isn't one that's going to go away because we all agree on it and everybody, you know, gets on board. This is going to be an ongoing conversation, I think, as long as the church is the church.
One quick final note for me on this is there is an element, as we begin transitioning to the eighth commandment, there's an element here of stewardship. And you think of stewardship, I think, most often from the financial context, the idea of what do we do with our resources. But here, we are called as Christians to be good stewards of the community that we've been given. And I know we have lots of people who have had lots of experience over your lifetime in different churches. I would have to guess that in one of our experiences, someone in this room has had an experience where a pastor broke the bounds of marriage and the impact that had on the church community. I've got to think statistically there's at least one of those stories that could be told in this room, because that happens way more frequently in the church than we would like to admit. The reality is, we're not just stewarding our bodies, and we're not just stewarding someone else's bodies. We're stewarding the covenantal relationship of the community. We're doing the best that we can to make it so that people can come to this place. And by place, we don't mean the building. We mean within this gathering of disciples, and they can hear the good news of Jesus Christ. It can be an inspiring message that calls them into a well-founded and life-giving relationship with the living God. This is what we aspire to do. And when we allow our sinfulness in any area to move us outside of good stewardship of what we've been given, then we put ourselves in a position for others to be impacted by that choice. And I think that is it's a different way to look at it, But it ties this commandment into the commandment that's going to follow. The next commandment's going to be far more clear in the sense that it's a stewardship commandment. But I think there's an element of stewardship in this commandment as well.
Okay. We move on. Our next commandment, thou shalt not steal. Again, pretty self-explanatory. Taking something that isn't yours on its surface. Pretty easy to check the box, yes or no. Under that very simple definition, we won't do confession. You just think about whether or not you have taken something that didn't belong to you. I think that's not an uncommon kind of thing. Certainly from a societal perspective, it makes sense. A community would be a place of trustworthiness. I have friends that live in other places who are just, they literally can't wrap their head around the fact that if you see my truck parked somewhere, the keys are in it. And that our house is open. So something disappears, right? And that's not to say you should or shouldn't do those things. It's just to say that the benefit of living even in a small bubble where you have a high degree or you feel the ability to have a high degree of trust in people is a wonderful blessing. There are places where clearly that is not a good plan and shouldn't be done. Arguably, it shouldn't be done at all. But how do we live with our stuff in a way that we are content with it? And how do we avoid taking from other people? I think this is the direction this commandment points us in.
Okay, I'm so excited for this. There are four levels. We're going to go from the top to the bottom. The first one, Calvin gives us four different levels of theft, okay? And I'm going to be curious how far we need to go before we all get really uncomfortable. All right. So first level, I think we're going to all be fine. Most of us, brazen and violent theft from another. So, you know, robbing somebody on the roadside, breaking into safes. I'm sure most of us feel pretty good at that. Okay, moving to the next one. Malicious deceit through fraud. So the idea of defrauding in any other form. So, by the way, that would include the government, because Calvin has a very high view of the government and its role in our lives. So whatever you owe someone else, if you fraudulently keep it from them, that is a form of theft. He goes on, it's getting good. Concealed craftiness. That's an exact quote. Concealed craftiness, where a person is parted with their goods by seemingly legal means, including when you take someone to court and win. He explicitly says this. You take someone to court and you win by the letter of the law, and you take the thing from them that belonged to them because you wanted it, even if you secured it through legal means. It is, in the eyes of God, Calvin would say, theft. And then we keep going down the line. Flatteries, where one is cheated of your things by being told what you want to hear. And there's entire industries built upon that, right? Oh, you will look great if you buy this product. You will be happy if you go to this place. That is a form of theft because you are essentially, you're using flattery to cheat someone out of what belongs to them for something that's in your own interest and not their own. And the principle underneath all four, no, I shouldn't move on. Did any of those land on any of you? They did on me. I thought to myself, wow, that's good. The thing that connects all four of those, right, is ultimately that every one of them violates our Christian responsibility to love our neighbor, which means that we owe to our neighbor. Our owing is that we look out for their legitimate best interests. And when it applies to stuff, the things that we've been made stewards of in our life, our calling is to ensure that other people's stuff remains their stuff because that was given to them by God. So if you take from them what God has given them, you are not just stealing from them, you are stealing from God. And that is a remarkable frame, because what it does is it says, it's not a question of how did I get it? It's a question of, does it belong to me? And that is a radically different way of turning this commandment. I think it lands in a different way.
So essentially then, I'm going to bring up a quote from Martin Luther. And this is where I think we take this commandment from, do not steal, which again, is a thing maybe at some point people pocket this. I'm amazed when you read the statistics of the Walmarts and Targets and Hy-Vees of the world, the millions to slash billions of dollars that they lose from just people taking things, who just find a way to walk out of the store with something they didn't pay for. I think most of us find that surprising. I don't think most of us are out there looking for those opportunities. And I'm not patting myself on the back intentionally, because I've got plenty of problems. But in honesty, I'm the guy you want finding your billfold. If you drop your billfold and it's full of money, I'll get it back to you and it'll be full of money. I don't know why that's not a thing that tempts me. Maybe I've never found a big enough billfold yet. But this happened a couple weeks ago. I left the store. Well, hold on. Let me read to you what Luther says first. Luther says, one steals not only when he robs a safe or picks a pocket, but also when he takes advantage of his neighbor at the market, the workshop, the grocery, the butcher, wherever money and goods or labor is exchanged. Now, this is when it goes from, I don't think I have to worry about that, to, oh, what does he mean? Anytime we take advantage of someone. You know that moment when the busy waitress gives you an extra $10 in your change? Yeah, so does Luther. Luther raises serious questions about that. When the store makes a mistake, when the clerk makes a mistake, when you work an angle and take advantage of something, when a person doesn't know what they have and you say, oh, I'll give you $5 for it when it's worth $500. Luther raises questions about whether this is honestly dealing with one another. And if it's not honestly dealing with one another, he's going to call it stealing. When we take something and we get an advantage in taking it. And for Luther, I mean, that sounds legalistic, and I'll grant that to you. But for Luther, this is connected to the idea that we don't own our own things. We are not free with our goods and money, that they belong to God, that they are on loan to us, and that we are indebted to Christ how we treat them. And as Michael said, that transfers to our neighbors as well, even, you know, corporations. You might find this surprising. I think I did. Both Calvin and Luther write page after page, hundreds of pages of theology on what it means to own something, starting with the question, should Christians own things? Again, keep in mind they're dealing with the Catholic Church and some of the Catholic order that said, no, a person shouldn't own anything. And if a Christian does own something, can we rightly call it ours? What do we do with that language? And so Luther raises all of this, as Calvin does. How do we think of what we quote-unquote own? How do we hold on to what we have with open hands? And how do we interact with others in a way that doesn't try to get the best of them and take something from them to our benefit, to our advantage. And in a kind of market-driven capitalist society, again, that's a tough question. I'm not blaming America for that being a tough question. It's been a tough question in all societies. But I think there's something here that is, again, I don't steal. Then you hear Luther and you go, oh man, Luther, come on. Maybe I need to think about some of this.
So we've not spent a lot of time in Westminster, but Westminster has a line in here that I thought we should spend a little time reflecting on together, because not just this question of ownership, but Westminster takes it further. Westminster teaches that this commandment should teach us to, and I quote, moderate our concerns for worldly goods. So in other words, it's not just whether we take from someone else, it's that our desire for other people's things should be moderated, that we should have control over our impulse and desire to accumulate and to acquire. And I shared this with Clint earlier. I'll share this with you. Public confession. This is Lent. So here we go. Confession from Michael Gwecki. I like collecting things. I like, most of them are digital things, like, you know, nerd things like video games, but there's also some techno gadgets in our house, as Rochelle will tell you, in somewhat increasing measure. I like collecting things. That I'm not in a good position here with this commandment. I'm not 100% certain what to do with that, to be honest with you, right? Is it the thing that has power over me, right? It is, or is it rather an enjoyment of a gift that's been given by God? Calvin would make room for both. Westminster would make room for both. But the motivation behind it is essential to be discerned correctly. And so that I do think that it's striking. It's not just do we take from others, but do we moderate our desire, that innate human desire to be jealous or envious of what another person has? That's the thing that would motivate us to take it in the first place. And then, very briefly, Westminster also included a category that I thought might interest us. It included that it is a sin not only to take from another or to desire to take from another, it's also a sin to steal from yourself, like gambling, or like horrible financial choices you should have known better, like imprudence. And the idea is that when you defraud yourself today of the benefits God has given you, you're scorning the thing that you were given to be steward of. So therefore, it is a violation of the commandment to also steal of the resources God gave you for your own betterment when you squander them on things that aren't for your betterment. Interesting interpretation.
That would come under a heading probably that we would call wastefulness. And again, if you think, how did we get from stealing to me not being able to use my money however I want? It has to do with this idea of what is ours, right? What is our responsibility to what we've been given? In a similar way that we talk about our sexuality, the gift we've been given, and the fences around it, how do we talk about our possessions and the fences around them? And it is not to produce guilt. It is to produce faithfulness. And so one of the dangers, the New Testament, this is Old Testament too, but it's especially apparent in the New Testament, that the danger of finance is that it convinces you that your security and future are in it. And so the thing that people are quickest to idolatrize is their stuff, their possessions, the things they need. You know, so it's the story that Jesus tells, the guy with bigger barns. I mean, you can read the Gospel of Luke. You'll be beaten down with possessions over and over and over again. But what does it mean to celebrate and use our resources appropriately to connect with others and not deprive them of their resources, but to do so under the idea of stewardship, that those are gifts, that they're not ours, they're not about us, and they're not simply for our enjoyment. They're for covenant relationship with God and with others. And so I think, you know, that's where this idea of wastefulness comes in. Now, I would actually say, and Michael, you can push back on this, I would actually say this is a place the church has to be careful. I don't think we should probably wade terribly far into that, because I think that tends to be a personal thing. You may go to Starbucks every day. I don't think the church should tell you if that's an appropriate use of your money. You may have more bicycles than would fit in one room. I don't think the church should tell me, that that's not okay. No, I do think that this is one of those places where the church should be upfront with principles. And then as Christians, we should seek what is the right balance for us. I think this is a place it's very easy to lapse into legalism. And I think it's very difficult to do that outside of the context of relationship. And so I think this is an important idea conceptually and spiritually, but I don't think it's one where the church should necessarily have a checklist for people, because we've tried that in the past and it hasn't worked very well.
I don't have much to add to that other than to say we've now been through four of the second side of the commandments. We're in the commandments about our relationship with one another. Just want to know this, every time and without exception, the Reformer's interpretation of the commandment is it's not a no. It's not just a stop sign. It is a stop sign. It's saying don't do these things. It's also saying do these things for the sake of your community, because this is what's best for you. It is truly wholehearted. The desire is that we might be a group of people who are living the best life that we can as stewards of God's best gifts to us. And the idea is you've been given stuff. You've been given your deepest relationships. You've been given your life. You've been given a relationship of learning from those who have gone before you, your superiors and those underneath you. All of this language exists for the purpose of us asking the question, how do I love my neighbor? And ultimately, that's what we come back to over and over again. So yes, as you go ask yourself the question, what do I do with these gifts that I've been made a steward of? And you might look at it in each one of those categories. The spirit you should bring to it is, how does God use this thing given to me in a way that blesses the people around me? How does this add life to the people that God calls son and daughter? And that is the guide that we come back to over and over again.
There's a wonderful verse in the New Testament that says, owe no one anything. Literally in the Greek says something like, owe no one nothing. And then it says, let no doubt remain outstanding except the continuing debt of love to one another. So the call for Christians to live their life financially, in which we're not indebted, we're not taking advantage, that our finances become a mechanism of how we show Christ's love in the world. And properly understood, that is a massive challenge, a massive task, because money claims to be so much more than money. It claims to be security. It claims to be status. It claims to be future. It claims to be importance. It masquerades as all of those things that the Christian rightly finds not in their bank account, but in God, their identity in Christ. And so how is it that we become the best stewards so that do not steal, as Michael said, isn't just the letter of the law. It's not a stop sign. It's a caution, obstacles ahead sign, right? This has to be navigated. So how do we do that well? I think ultimately that's where that commandment points us. It's an interesting, I think from a sociological standpoint, the commandment do not steal is difficult. I mean, Just recently helped a family member who got a link and clicked the link and gave a credit card. And, you know, people are out there every day just trying to create ways to steal from other people. And it certainly can leave us jaded. It certainly can leave us with the impression that, you know, it's your own fault. If that happens to you, you should have been smarter. And yeah. But again, the world lives one way and the church is to live another way. And so it's an interesting time. Everybody agrees that going and holding your neighbor up with a gun and taking their stuff is not okay. But there's that gray area is where it gets interesting.
Hey, we want to thank you for listening to this broadcast. We're grateful for the support and the connections, the relationships we get to make through some of these offerings. We hope that they've been helpful. We know that there are lots of choices that you have, lots of things you can listen to. We want to make you aware of some of what we're doing, and we greatly appreciate you being a part of it.
Absolutely. We want to just thank you for being one of our audio podcast listeners. It's amazing to have you with us in the midst of our conversations. Of course, I hope you know that you can find the whole archive of all of these conversations at pastortalk.co. We would love for you to join us there. You can find options for subscribing by email. You can easily share things there with other people who you think might appreciate recordings like this. And of course, we just want to welcome you. If you're ever interested in joining us for the video podcast, you can do that on YouTube. It is youtube.com/FPC Spirit Lake. There you can comment and engage with us. Or if you would prefer to do that without going to YouTube, you can actually just click the link in the description of this podcast where you will be able to send us a form and information and reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you and engage in conversation with you. Thanks again for taking time to be with us. We look forward to our next conversation and can't wait to see you then.